Welcome to It's All Journalism. This is our second podcast. I'm Megan Cloherty here with Michael O'Connell. And we are just kind of starting off taking our first leap, if you will, into exploring how technology and online journalism mesh.
And that's pretty much it. And what we're trying to do is talk to professionals who use online journalism, who work in the field, and sort of glean from them the lessons they've learned, the things that are going on in this sort of rapidly changing industry.
So the Huffington Post, obviously, is one of the leaders in online journalism when it comes to social media. And if you follow their tweets, this company is like a social media machine. I mean, every tweet that comes out is clickable. So we wanted to know how Huffington Post maintains such a strong online presence while sort of taming the beast that's constantly growing. I mean, they always have content coming in. And then dissecting that and sharing it out on social media channels in a way that consumers can respond to. So we have Ethan Clapper with us joining us now. He runs social media at Huffington Post's political page. Thank you for joining us, Ethan.
Thanks for having me.
We were just wanting to talk about how Huffington Post sort of, I mean, I guess we'll start here. There is so much content coming in constantly. I mean, every news organization has that problem. Blessing,
it's a plus.
Right. How does Huffington Post even out what it's sending out on social media? How does it decide sort of when to send things? And is it all automated or do you guys decide that?
All of those tweets you see and all of those Facebook posts you see from the Huffington Post are being written by humans. we are
not
deciding.
Robots.
Not robots, no. We are deciding, in my case at least, what to put out based off of what does well, because we know what does well for our audience. We know our audience pretty well. So that's especially the case with Facebook. There are certain topics that play very well on Facebook. For instance, marijuana legalization is a big one, as is anything about abortion rights or, you know, any kind of positive polls for the president, because we do tend to be a bit more of a left-leaning news organization. On Twitter, the bar is a little lower just because we can post more tweets than we can do Facebook posts. But we try to write those tweets in a way that will get people to both engage with the tweets, so retweet them and that kind of a thing, but also to click through them and to further engage with our content by reading the content and commenting on the content.
So a tweet like, for example, one that I saw this week where of Newt Gingrich picking up his repaired iPad at the Apple store in Georgetown, which you tweeted, I thought was sort of indicative of maybe not the high point of journalism, but sort of indicative of the way that how we're engaging readers.
Exactly. And I make it a point not to have all of the tweets that go out on at HuffPostPol, which is the account that I manage, be Huffington Post content. I do retweet our competitors. I do retweet other reporters. I do retweet politicians in the case of Newt Gingrich going to the Apple store to get his iPad fixed. So I, you know, I try to curate something that our audience will like. And that's not just Huffington Post content.
You know, you've been at the HuffPo now since March. When you started there, was there discussion about sort of maintaining a voice for social media, especially on Twitter, when you're interacting with not only loyal users, but new users that tweet you or retweet you?
There was no formal discussion, but it is all about the voice and getting to learn that voice and getting to tweet and Facebook and communicate with our audience in that voice that our audience is used to. And coming from a place like National Journal, which is where I came from, it's a very kind of old school inside the Beltway publication. It was a bit of an adjustment for me to learn that voice, but I'm really starting to get the hang of it. And our audience is reacting very positively to me getting the hang of it. They are engaging a lot more now that I know what they're used to.
So who is the real Ethan Clapper? I mean, you have you do HuffPo the tweets on that, but you also have your own at Ethan Clapper's your Twitter account. What's your voice? How do you differentiate? But what you're putting on your own, you know, what you're putting on the HuffPost? How do you strike this balance?
Well, I certainly try to be very informative, but also have a lot of fun while I am being informative. So I'll be snarkier on my personal accounts. You know, I'll tweet sillier things. For instance, whenever Chuck Grassley, the senator from Iowa, tweets, and he doesn't do a very good job of it, he often just will tweet one character or at himself, as was the case fairly recently when he did that. And we all make fun of it. In fact, Twitter erupts. All of the people who follow politics on Twitter kind of erupt whenever Chuck Grassley tweets. And I actually had a debate when this happened. Should I make fun of it on my account or should I make fun of it on politics? And I decided against making fun of it on the politics account because we have a much broader audience and a lot of our followers will not get a joke I make about that. And they could even reply to us and complain, what are you talking about? So I really try to, know my distinct audiences and to know what would work for each audience. And that was a perfect example, I feel.
I see a lot more tweets than I see Facebook interactions from HuffPo, and that might just be what I'm seeing. But is there a Twitter over Facebook mentality, or is it more about a mobile mentality?
Well, you're absolutely right. There are more Twitter postings than there are Facebook postings. That's just really a function of how Facebook algorithms work and everything. And we have a minimum 20-minute spacing between Facebook posts. Twitter posts, you really don't have that restriction because it moves so much faster. So my account on politics, it's about 15 minutes during the day between tweets, but sometimes less. And then on Facebook, it's also 20 minutes. So really just as a matter of what we can and can't do. And because if you start Facebooking less than that, you start getting penalized and your stuff stops showing up in news feeds. And we don't want that, obviously.
So do you have a minimum in a day of either tweeting or Facebook posts?
I don't have an actual numerical quota or anything, but I do try to have at least one post every hour for 24 hours. And we just are doing that to reach different audiences in the middle of the night or during the weekend, people who might not normally be engaging with us during the day.
We were talking before about politics, politicians. Who's good to follow? Who's a really good tweeter?
In terms of politicians?
Yeah.
I think Claire McCaskill, the senator from Missouri, she's fantastic. She does the tweeting herself. She's using it now, her Twitter account, to campaign for her reelection. But before, she was using it to spread policy points to engage with people in Missouri. Also, I actually like some of the House Republican freshmen on Twitter because they do tend to be a younger bunch. They're more likely to use social media. This is not a name frequently tossed around, but I think Congressman Dennis Ross from Florida, he's kind of a riot on Twitter. He's actually very funny.
It's funny because I follow several congressmen, and sometimes you can clearly tell that this is a staff person who's doing it. But it's nice to hear that there are some people who are actually sort of engaged in the medium and understanding that it's more powerful when you use when you have your voice in there.
Ethan and I were talking before about deciding what to share. Because sometimes it's tricky. I mean, sometimes you have sort of an interesting tweet from a congressman that maybe is more lighthearted, but then you have this big story that's developing. And how do you, decide sort of which way to go? Do you ever hold anything? I mean, I know you were saying it's sort of situational, but do you have any example of how to prioritize what you share on Twitter versus Facebook?
It's actually very similar. Obviously, a breaking story takes precedent over anything. A story that's more important in general takes precedent. This is where really, my journalism skills come into play. I'm using my news judgment to determine what needs to go in what order, and I can alter that order, and I do frequently. A perfect example, it was Friday, and the Romney campaign released Paul Ryan's tax returns in the epitome of a classic Friday news dump. It dropped around 6 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of us were ready to head out. And then we see that, wow, we have to do this. And I had already had some content scheduled to go out through the evening. And I was like, no, I got to move this. We got to move this and all of that, because this is a lot more important. We got to get out these stories about Paul Ryan's tax returns. So,
well, and not only that, but it would look kind of silly if you, did one Paul Ryan tax return and then the next one was a funny tweet from Representative Ross.
I mean, and then we wouldn't hear from you again until Monday morning about the.
So you do have to change things over, is what you're saying, right? I mean, if something happens, you have to just sort of reroute the bus.
Right. And if there was ever a massive breaking story, what I would do would be to either pause or delete all of my tweets that were set to go out. And I would delete all of my scheduled Facebook posts, and I would just go and work this story. I had to do a little of that, actually, when they announced Paul Ryan. It was an overnight period, late evening overnight period, and there was stuff all scheduled for that period, and I had to move it or delete it because it was not relevant.
It's funny that you're saying that the Romney campaign made this announcement sort of at 6 p.m. on Friday. It used to be, you know, in journalism, it was if you wanted to get your story out that you would announce it on a Sunday, because there was no other news that you're going to be competing with on Monday morning. But now we're in a 24-hour news cycle. And, you know, certainly people had to deal with that when we got into 24-hour cable news. But now, you know, when you have instantaneous news via Twitter and Facebook and other social media, you're a very young journalist. You know, what are you seeing as far as how people are sort of taking advantage of the strengths, the timeliness of social media?
Well, I have an example of how they weren't, and this really surprised me, and I'm just going to go back to the Paul Ryan announcement. I was talking to some colleagues and some of my friends who work at competing organizations, and we were like, why on earth is he announcing his running mate at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning when the entire West Coast is asleep? Well, somebody, you can call her an old school journalist, replied to me on Twitter and said, well, they want to monopolize the Sunday papers and the Sunday talk shows. Mm-hmm. And my reaction was that that's just a very old fashioned mentality. And sure enough, you know, there were a lot of tweets and other social postings surrounding the Paul Ryan pick last Saturday, but there could have been more. And mm-hmm. it was not a good time to be announcing that, to take advantage of this, because you have most of the country sleeping.
And it's funny because what'll happen is, you know, certainly the big outlets like MSNBC, CNN, Fox News are all following, you know, social media. So they're going to be jump all over that story on Saturday. And, you know, they may look on Sunday morning and say, well, and Monday certainly, and say, well, do we really want to, you know, make this the focus of our story since it's kind of played out on a Saturday?
Right. Well, it brings up the whole, you know, social media going into the election. I mean, are you seeing sort of a change? You mentioned Claire McCaskill campaigning on her Twitter account, but are you seeing some politicians who are active on Twitter sort of amping that up a little bit? Or
I think you see more postings on the presidential side for sure. There was a report out recently from the Pew Project for Excellence in Journalism, a great organization. I follow their work closely, about the social media and the election. It's a study they do every 4 years. It was originally digital campaigning. Now it has shifted more to just the social side. And it was looking at Romney versus Obama during a period in June. And that was kind of a low period where there wasn't that much going on. And Obama was doing a lot more, but Romney was doing like one post a day on Twitter and, you know, not that much. And I certainly, since things have heated up, in the past couple of weeks, Obama, Romney, all of their advisors, all of that tweeting has definitely ramped up. Facebook posts have definitely ramped up. I think you see it on some down ballot races as well. I think, you know, a perfect example would be Elizabeth Warren, who's campaigning as a Democrat to replace Scott Brown as the senator from Massachusetts. And she has a very robust digital presence, and you can see a lot more coming out of her personal account in the past couple of weeks.
So it's not only politicians, obviously, that you cover. I mean, you're kind of watching sort of the whole social sphere as far as how they're responding to politics, I'm sure. This brings me back to, we were talking about, you had a blog on 10,000 words a while ago about what your prediction was for online journalism in 2012. And you mentioned the tweet first, report second mentality, which when it started, that wasn't so hot among managers.
Not at all.
But now, are you seeing your prediction sort of play out this year, or what are you thinking?
I still see a lot of news organizations where it's very obvious they have this this policy to follow, where you gotta wait for a story, a scoop that they have to go through the newsroom to be vetted to make sure that happens. You have to make sure that they get it right. And because if you get it wrong, it becomes a serious question of integrity and accuracy and all of that. And I can understand some of that. But at the same time, I think that people would just rather just like to tweet. And we have that mentality at the Huffington Post for the most part, where we can just, you know, we see something, we can tweet it without a link. I can do it on my personal account. I can do it on the HuffPost politics account. I could even do it on the main at Huffington Post account, which is followed by more than 2 million people now. So it really depends. It's a real question of branding, engagement, traffic also. Because if we got it out fast with a link, more people would probably be clicking the link and we'd be getting the traffic.
you know, just speaking strictly from a news outlet's standpoint, if they've got a reporter in the field who's covering something who gets a scoop and then has to decide, well, do I tweet it and then tip off my competition? So there's this hesitancy, and I know in some newsrooms where they want to own the story, but the fact is you don't own stories.
Not anymore.
You may be at an event where a politician makes a gaffe or says something, and you know there are 20 people in that crowd who are going to tweet it out. So the rules are sort of changing.
I agree. There are still some examples at HuffPost where we just have to be very careful. I keep talking about the Paul Ryan selection, but I'm going to go back and use this as an example. We were the second outlet to break that story. We were a couple of minutes after Chuck Todd at NBC News broke it. We had sourcing. We had a story we were sitting on that said Paul Ryan was going to be the pick. And I was explicitly told not to tweet this until it's been vetted, not to talk about it, not to do anything until the story has been edited, vetted, and published. And that's what I did. And we were right. We were second, but we were right. Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling if we had gone too fast, we would have tipped off mm-hmm. some people. That's certainly where we did feel probably more comfortable about running with it after Chuck Todd had the story, nailed down. So
it's sort of an interesting dynamic there, because, and especially for HuffPost, where you guys aren't afraid to link to a competitor.
That's something that has been part of HuffPost since day one in 2005. It's what we call a link out. It's when we take a story from a competitor, take the first paragraph or two, and just you go to the main page, or you go to the politics page, and you click it, and it actually just takes you directly to the story. So we try to mirror that to an extent on social media. It's not necessarily the same content, but it's why I'm allowed to do that kind of thing where we retweet the competitors, because that's what we're all about.
Mm-hmm. Because it's sort of a weird dynamic when HuffPost came along and all the newsrooms were resistant. Oh, they're stealing our content. They're not creating their own content, and not seeing the fact that they were developing a brand that was serving readers. In 2008, there was a lot of talk about Obama's use of social media, and people were expecting to see a lot of, the intervening elections, sort of a take those lessons that Obama, because many people credit him for sort of embracing social media and using it well. You know, as an observer of social media, have you seen that that's sort of what's going on?
Yes, absolutely. I think you saw it very clearly in the 2010 midterm elections, especially among Republicans who were trying to make up this big deficit they had on digital campaigning and, trying to match what the Democrats had put out in 2008. And I think the playing field is a bit leveled, but at the same time, I think we do see a very conservative approach still to social media in general, because people are very message conscious on the internet and in general on these campaigns. And the 24-second news cycle that we're in, any kind of weird posting, any kind of potentially off-message thing will get dissected and become immediately the story of the day. Mm-hmm. So people are very, very cautious. And that's why you were seeing one tweet a day from the Romney campaign and not many more from the Obama campaign.
I thought it was kind of interesting. I mean, when you think about social media and journalism, obviously the big two are Twitter and Facebook, right? But are you guys either you personally kind of seeing if it's working out, or is HuffPo experimenting with Foursquare or any other kind of, social media sharing
LinkedIn.
That maybe isn't so mainstream as far as, the older readers, but could eventually pick up and be used in a different way?
We're always looking into what the next big thing is. We're always one of the first news sites to join these networks. We do have other channels. We are on Instagram. We are on Tumblr. We are on Pinterest. We are on a new service called Rebel Mouse, which was actually founded by our former, I believe he was our chief technology officer, a guy by the name of Paul Berry. And it is a service that just takes all of your social postings and makes it into a really beautiful looking page. And it's a great way to engage with us socially without having to follow our social channels. Because social media and what goes out on social media is really becoming part of the story itself. And you do, I do sincerely think you are missing things if you are not following this kind of story on social media, especially with the elections. I think that we are looking for the next big thing. I mean, obviously, the audiences aren't the same on those other sites. Obviously, you're not going to get the kind of traffic that you get on Facebook or Twitter. Looking at those, you know, coming off of those websites, but you do get people to engage with your brand and your content in a new venue, and you can get new readers that way.
But I imagine it's difficult. I mean, you obviously have to maintain the same voice, but on Pinterest, you have to find a great picture that's going to, you know, draw people in. And in Foursquare, I mean, it's sort of, you have to approach it differently, approach stories differently. Is that right?
Yes, you have to find what story works for what audience, and every audience is different. And obviously, not just Pinterest, but I'd also say Tumblr, and obviously with Instagram, it's all about the pictures. Mm-hmm. The story has to have a good picture to be worth it. And you know, there are some exceptions, but I'm not going to put some wonky budget story up on Tumblr.
Right.
I think one of the reasons why journalists have sort of gravitated so aggressively towards Twitter is because a lot of its perceived weaknesses are actually some of its strengths. The fact that it moves so quickly, the fact that it's very small, and that you link and you're sending people to other places.
As a journalist, I think absolutely. That's our most invaluable social media tool in terms of what we use as journalists to find stories, to engage with our readers, to see what's trending, get a bit of a snapshot. You walk into the Huffington Post Washington Bureau, and there are very few computer screens that don't have TweetDeck on them. We are always looking at that, and it is essential. It is, I did not coin this, but, and you've probably heard this before, but it's really the 21st century police scanner. It's the first draft of everything. Not everything you see on Twitter is accurate, and that's a big downside to it, and that's just the nature of how fast things are and how short things are and how impulsive people are on Twitter. But with the right kind of verification techniques, making sure other people have it, making sure you can follow up on something, I think it's just a fantastic way to, you know, find things and to engage. The only thing I can really caution on the macro scale about Twitter is that there are, you know, the majority of Americans are not on Twitter. In fact, not many are. And you can get sucked into this echo chamber where what you think your audience thinks is important because of what they think is important on Twitter is not necessarily what your actual audience thinks is important. And it's, that was a big adjustment for me when I started at Huffington Post, and I was just cautioned time after time not to solely rely on Twitter for my ideas. I have to rely on what I think my audience will like.
Obviously, Huffington Post is doing something very right when it comes to social media. But when you took the job, was there like a weakness you saw? Was there something that you wanted to improve upon that they maybe weren't doing as well as they could have?
Well, I think that for certainly my politics Twitter account was really just blasting out HuffPost headlines. And I was encouraged at the end of my last week, actually, to just have more fun with it. I mean, it was not something that was done before I started there, really. I mean, there probably were some exceptions, but I came from an organization that was very conservative about doing that, and I just was told essentially to relax and have fun and retweet what you think is newsworthy, even if it's from our direct competitors. So I'm glad that I was able to do that quite easily, and I think that people are really seeing that and noticing that and looking to us as just a great place to find political news from multiple sources.
Something you said before, it just sort of struck me that we haven't really talked about, and that's reader engagement. And, you know, how do you engage your readers at Huffington Post? How do you communicate with them, and how do they communicate with you?
Well, there are a couple of different things I do to that are really ways to just get them talking. Almost every day I do a caption contest with a photo that I find on the wires or through the White House Flickr feed or some other source with a photo that we're allowed to use. And I will say, here's a funny looking photo of Barack Obama. Here's a funny looking photo of Mitt Romney. And I will get our readers to tweet us how the photo should be captioned, and I'll get our readers to leave comments below the story about how the photo should be captioned. And then I take those best tweets, those best comments, I put them into a slideshow, and everybody looks at the captions and laughs, and it's really a lot of fun. Our readers love it, and it really does get them talking. Probably a more frequent thing I will do for engagement would be on our Facebook page, and that is when I post a story, I'll put as the status a question or something, and I will say, should Mitt Romney release more tax returns? That's a very basic one, but sometimes the basic ones do the best. I'll get hundreds of Facebook comments about it, and you get debates, and it really starts a conversation. And these people's friends see that they're commenting on it, and they see, oh, this looks like a fun conversation. So they'll like our page, and they'll start commenting. And this is how we grow our audience.
My own personal experience with Facebook, as far as journalism goes, is Facebook compared to Twitter. Twitter, it's pretty easy to kind of grasp the usefulness as a journalist. You certainly also can link out your stories. But Facebook sometimes is a mystery to me. I know that the goal is to get people to like your stories and sort of build up your audience. What are the, how does Huffington Post use Facebook? What's their goal? Help me solve this mystery that is called Facebook.
Facebook, a lot of our traffic comes off of Facebook, and not explicitly from our pages, but just people sharing our stories. And it's a big source of traffic for the Huffington Post. And that's very important to us. We also use it on the pages as an engagement tool. As a journalist who uses Twitter to find breaking news and story ideas, I don't get my breaking news off of Facebook. I don't try to get my breaking news off of Facebook. Sometimes I'll see something for the first time on Facebook, but probably not intentional. I'm always looking at Twitter for that. So I think that Facebook is probably more of a way to get our audience talking, get them talking and getting others to see what they say. I mean, I can get my audience talking on Twitter too, and I do sometimes, but those people who are talking on Twitter about our stories and replying to me about it, they're not, the others aren't seeing, what they're saying. And it's very hard to start a dialogue, to start a conversation. Mm-hmm. So Facebook is really great for that. It's great to share media, so pictures that we're allowed to use, because that's a big issue, is the copyright. And it's a big debate in every newsroom now, not just ours. Yet people sharing that kind of media, it's probably a little bit better than Twitter, even though you can share pictures through Twitter as well. But I think that just the way that they're displayed on Facebook is beautiful because of how they've made some changes, made the pictures bigger, and how they're displayed and all of that. So I think there are definitely some advantages. Breaking news, probably not the biggest.
Mm-hmm. Even though I say this, it's a mystery to me. My own experience on Federal News Radio, which is my day job, is that the tendency is that Facebook, you seem to get more bang with your buck. And I think it might be a lot of it because of what you're saying, is that you can put it, you can combine in other media, or actually sort of use a lot of the strengths you may have in your own website.
Exactly.
I like what he said too. It's more of a discussion board, almost like a comment board, whereas Twitter is just one way, in Facebook, it's all, well, I mean, I'm a fan of Facebook.
Oh, no. Twitter's like, here's the news.
No, but I like on Facebook that if you share something, it's all contained. It's all, it's all in one spot. So you can see, especially from your job, you can see how it would be advantageous to be able to see people not only interacting with you and your product, but with each other, and sort of building that discussion and having a better idea of what they're looking for from that debate.
Absolutely. It does help us in determining, what our audience likes, obviously. I mean, the engagement numbers on a Facebook page are there for everyone to see in terms of likes, shares, comments, the number of those we see. I also have other engagement numbers through the analytics tool on Facebook called Insights. It shows me some actual hard numbers about how many people saw a post and how it was shared, and the sentiment surrounding that post, which, not always accurate, because when you do sentiment analysis, it doesn't really capture sarcasm that well. So it's kind of tricky, but it's pretty cool, and it does help us, and we just get a full picture of it from that and looking at also just general traffic numbers and other things as well. So it's a very, very inclusive approach to how we're looking at these things.
See, I sometimes feel that when I tweet something, it's I'm putting a message in a bottle and throwing it in the ocean. And I hope, it's like, oh, this is an amazing story. People are gonna pass. This is gonna go viral. And it just disappears. And even my friends won't retweet it. And it's just like, well, you know, it's kind of like, well, what's the effort? What do I have to do? But Facebook, it for some reason seems to...
It lives longer.
Yeah. People sort of engage it. And I think it's almost even friendlier, I guess. Maybe it gives you an opportunity to sort of define who you are and create your identity.
I'd say it's probably less intimidating. Obviously, the audience on Facebook is a lot bigger.
And older.
Than the audience on Twitter. And there are more people on Facebook right now than there are Americans. And if you look at just the raw numbers of Facebook users, not necessarily that they're not all necessarily active accounts, but you know, there are about 310 million Americans, and there's something like 700 million or some really high number like that Facebook users.
Yeah, I've got 10 accounts.
So yeah, it's Michael's fault.
Yeah. I'm inflating those numbers.
So I don't know if we want to like wind down here a little bit, but I thought I'd ask Ethan. We have to ask you people to follow on Twitter. I mean, this is what you do. You've got to have some good accounts that we can follow.
Yeah. In terms of the social journalism sphere, I think that goes without saying that my colleague at HuffPost, a guy by the name of Craig Canale, at C Canal, C-K-A-N-A-L, and he is just, you know, the mayor of HuffPost. he used to run social for HuffPost. Now he does some senior editing surrounding live events, and he's just so on top of all of the trends and all of the new announcements and what's new on social. And anyone in this field who's into social journalism should be following him. He's just fantastic. I also think Matthew Ingram from GigaOM is a great follow, at Matthew I. He is very fast to write a quick analysis of what just happened in social journalism, and he's just really, really on top of it there. I think that the old mainstays on Twitter, I'd say the competing academics, Jay Rosen from New York University, at @JRosen_NYU. Just a genius, such smart insights about this kind of stuff. And then Jeff Jarvis, who is at City University of New York and has written some great things. He wrote a book, What Would Google Do? Mm-hmm. Very good read.
Yeah, definitely. It certainly changes your perspective about the web. And also your Twitter account, which is Ethan Klapper, K-L-A-P-P-E-R. And you tweet out which account on... HuffPost?
I tweet out from HuffPost Pal with one L.
And just since we are entering, just one last thing to ask you about. It would be bad if we didn't ask you about this. You know, November's just down the road. You know, what do the two campaigns, do you think, need to be doing in social media that they're not doing right now?
I think they need to be engaging more with citizens and really, really making the case to our population on social media, how they're different and what they bring to the table, and they're really not doing that right now. And it is roughly quoting what that Pew report I mentioned earlier said, they're using social media in a very antisocial way, and that's true, and it's a big opportunity, but I don't think it's going to change really, because they're very message conscious, and it's... And you have us journalists to thank for why they're so message conscious, but
because every mistake they make, we dice it and slice it,
right,
and send it
right
on out.
I think that using social media to reach young voters is a huge opportunity, because young voters live on social media, not just the ones who do it for a living like me. So I think that it's a huge opportunity, and they just need to seize that opportunity a little bit better in general.
All right. Well, Ethan, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time and your insights. You will find this on itsalljournalism.com, and we will be back next week with more, I guess.
Yeah, and we'll make sure we put the addresses that you can follow Ethan on, and also the people that he mentioned, so that you can follow them as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.